Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Ronald Mackay. Each week, we visit with authors, editors, or publishers who have regional or local connections. We hope to find out a little about their lives, ask them what prompts them to write, give them an opportunity to read some of their work for us, and we're very pleased to have Ronald Mackay with us today. Ronald Mackay was born in Cooper Angus, Scotland, in 1942. After leaving school, he travelled and worked in Spain and the Canary Islands for 2 years. He completed an MA at Aberdeen University, paying for his studies by serving in the 3rd Battalion Territorial Gordon Highlanders and working vacations in London as a postman, skin grader with the Hudson's Bay Company, and Bricky's labourer. Upon graduating in 1967, he was appointed to teach phonetics at Bucharest University, Romania. After leaving Romania in 1969, Ronald pursued problem-solving as a career, until the early 90s as a university professor of applied linguistics. From the mid-90s, using his expertise in program evaluation, a discipline in which he wrote his doctorate, Ronald worked all over the world to improve the planning, management, monitoring, and evaluation of agricultural research and development projects. In 2012, he retired, and he and his wife, Viviana, returned to Canada. Ronald and his wife, who is Peruvian, live in the home they built in 2009 on the shores of Rice Lake near Keene, Ontario. He has 2 stepdaughters and 4 grandchildren. So, Ronald, this is your first published book of a personal or fictional nature. Yes?
Yes, it is. I've actually published several books, but these were all professional in nature, either academic or technical.
Yes.
But when I retired in 2012, I decided that I would sever all links with my earlier careers, and I began trying to write plays for the radio and theatre. Peterborough is a wonderful place for the creative arts, and I've had lots of encouragement, in particular from Script Club and from the Theatre on King. Mm-hmm. And then last summer, at my wife's urging, I took a memoir writing workshop with Diane Taylor. Mm-hmm. A few months later, I finished a play I was working on, and Viviana urged me to write a memoir. But a memoir project wasn't really very clear to me. So to work myself into the right frame of mind, I began writing an exploratory preface. Writing that short introduction to my memoir did the trick, and I was able to write solidly every single day for the next several months. And this volume, A Scotsman Abroad, is the result.
Well, as a matter of fact, Diane Taylor had told me that you had written your memoir in a very short time. She was so impressed. And, you know, she belongs to our Spirit of the Hills writers group.
So yes.
We know her well. Now, your memoir covers events in your life that occurred at a very specific time and place, more than 45 years ago, from 1967 to 1969. So you've travelled all over the world and no doubt had many adventures. What drew you to this particular segment of your life as a subject for your memoir?
That's a really good question. And I've wondered about that myself. Of all the countries I've lived and worked in, why start with Romania? The answer is that when I begin a writing project, any writing project, it's very important for me to find a starting point that opens the door and takes me by the hand, so to speak, and leads me through the door to the other side. And for me, the year 1967 was that open door for a number of very important reasons. I was 25 years old. I just completed my MA at Aberdeen University. And although I'd had a series of odd jobs, I was about to enter the serious professional world for the very first time. And my first appointment was as exchange professor of phonetics to Bucharest University, part of the cultural agreement between the governments of Romania and the United Kingdom. And so in the summer of 67, when I left Aberdeen by train for London and then Paris and then boarded the Orient Express for Bucharest, I was starting a completely new phase in my life. And that period turned out to be so different and so intense that it's been forever indelibly imprinted on my mind. And of course, I thought these 2 years in Romania would be a single chapter in a wider ranging book, spanning the world and perhaps the whole of my professional life. But Romania took over completely. And so just a few months and 200,000 words later, I'd written an entire book about these two memorable years in that fascinating country.
Well, that's terrific, though. Now you've got a whole series of books that you can write in the future.
It would seem so.
So what kind of challenges did you face writing it?
I face a lot of challenges, and the very first was emotional. I felt embarrassed to write about myself. It seemed like an act of vanity. How could my little life possibly offer much interest? But as soon as I put pen to paper, I discovered that the memoir wasn't really about me. It was about an obscure and exotic and distant country. It told an unusual set of experiences in a period of time steeped in mystery and political intrigue. And its pages produced characters whose lives were far more gripping than my own. So it isn't really about me. It's about people, places, and events seen through my eyes. And that comforted me.
Had you recorded your thoughts at the time? Did you keep a journal of some sort?
I had nothing to go on at all except my memory.
And the That's amazing.
Odd thing was, when I started writing, I was back there on a daily basis. I was in the streets of Bucharest. I was up on the crests of the Carpathian Mountains. I wrote it in Peru, and I would go out to do some shopping for lunch or dinner, and I expected to see everything Romanian, and I was disoriented because I was so engaged in writing this purely from memory.
Well, how about reading us a piece from A Scotsman Abroad?
I'd be delighted to. I have to give a little background first.
Okay.
This chapter is called Karen. Barely a month after my arrival in Bucharest, I was approached by a very confident and very good-looking young woman, not a student, who claimed that she wanted me to return an English dictionary she had borrowed from my predecessor. I agreed, but when we met, she apologized for forgetting to bring the dictionary. Karen and I began to meet every week, and the matter of the dictionary never arose again. Karen was a delightful companion. She had graduated in the top five of her class with a degree in Russian history and now held a government post in cultural affairs. An urbane person, she liked the city's historical monuments, art galleries, and beautifully maintained parks. This arrangement with Karen was, I reflected, almost ideal. She had approached me, and our association was not one that she felt compromised by. I had a lovely and intelligent companion, and our meetings were an oasis in my otherwise rather solitary life. At first, Karen was very formal and businesslike, but as the weeks and months passed, she began to flirt a little. Content I may have been, but Karen was showing signs of becoming less so. Initially, she had shown no interest in my apartment, but now she wanted to see it. I successfully ignored her hints. One afternoon, we were caught in a shower of rain and got wet, and she suggested we go to my place to dry off. It became obvious that this afternoon she intended to put the seal on our friendship. I hesitated, unwilling to complicate my life in ways my imagination could only exaggerate. I made a split-second decision and forestalled Karen before the point of no return. Karen, yes? I think we should stop seeing each other. She burst into tears. I was taken aback, but must admit to feeling slightly flattered. I put my arms around her in as comradely a way as I could. Karen, You are a beautiful, well-educated woman. Any young man would be happy to have you as his girlfriend. She pushed free from my embrace, stopped crying, and looked at me with incredulity. You think it's you I'm crying for, she said. She saw my puzzlement, drew a deep breath, and spelled it out for this dolt of a Scotsman. I'm not crying about you. Listen, she continued, tears gone. I'm a member of the intelligentsia. I'm ambitious. When I was 16, I was invited to become a member of the Young Communists. That brought benefits, holidays, a guaranteed place in the university, a good job. But to improve, I must be invited to join the Communist Party. Then I will get my own apartment, a better job, perhaps the opportunity to travel abroad. I listened in fascinated silence. I've reported on short-term visitors from abroad for the secret police for several years. This year they entrusted me to report on you, just you, for the entire year. If you break off with me, I can't perform my duty. I will fail, and failure will count against me. It is for me that I cry. More tears. So the dictionary was just an excuse. It worked, didn't it? She blinked. I nodded. She went on. I decided that since you've been here for 4 months and have failed to find yourself a real girlfriend, I would be doing you a favour. My self-satisfaction crumbled. I'd flattered and deceived myself. Karen saw me as a loser. Here I was, a Westerner, in liberal Romania, surrounded by beautiful, flirtatious girls, but due to some inexplicable deficiency in my character or upbringing, I'd never managed to get together with a single one of them. Karen's sympathy for this flawed Scotsman was so great that she thought she'd do him the favour of becoming his lover as well as his informer for the rest of the year and so complete her assignment with the secret police with flying colours. I was too astonished and felt my shortcomings too acutely to laugh at the irony of the situation. Karen stopped crying, dried her eyes, and returned to business. I have a proposal that will suit both of us. No romance now in her voice. Proposal? Like the smart Romanian she was, her mind was 5 steps ahead of mine. If you continue to see me once every 2 weeks until the end of your contract, I promise you 2 things. I was still struggling to catch up. I promise you that I will never report anything that might compromise you or any of your friends, and when my assignment on you has been completed, I will never inconvenience you again. We both win. I kept my side of the bargain and continued to meet Karen every couple of weeks until my first year contract expired. I was able to appear with her in public without compromising her. But Karen took revenge for the humiliation she felt at my rejection of what she had offered. At the beginning of my second year in Bucharest, the secret police engaged a homosexual man to pursue me. When I eventually found this out, Congreve's classic line came to mind. Heaven has no rage like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned.
Thank you very much, Ronald. Now we'll take a short break.